Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
You can see that there are themes here. Inflammation is certainly a theme. We started to ask, what's inducing stress? What's inducing inflammation? And is there an environment where we can study these two things in a compressed time frame? And really started to look at space-based research, predicting and preventing accelerated stem cell aging and cancer evolution. When Danny said, hey, why is this happening? Why are some people having their pre-cancer become a full-blown cancer? Is there a loss of immune surveillance? Are the stem cells distracted? And we all know Danny, he says, find where there is the most need, go where you can do the most good. And that's where our entire raison d'etre is. So I'd like everybody who's involved with the Sanford Stem Cell Institute and my lab to stand or at least wave. So you're surrounded. There are a lot of us here. So you can see this is a whole community. Some of us went up to SpaceX to see how we can expand this idea of working in space with NASA, leading the charge, but also with commercial companies. So this goes back to a sense of urgency. When it comes to detecting, you know, accelerated aging, pre-malignancy, malignant disorders, you don't want time to slip by. When time lets slip a little perfect hour, oh, take it, for it will not come again. And that's from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam that our mom used to read to my sister Chris and I. And it's certainly what's behind the cancer moonshot. I was very fortunate to go there in March because we'd done tumor organoids in space. And they said, Kat, how come you can't start from an earlier stage of disease? And all the astronauts turned around and looked at me and said, do I have clonal hematopoiesis? Do I have these mutations that are going to accelerate the activation of downstream signaling factors and leukemia ultimately? I wanted to show this picture because this is John Dick and I in Bariloche in southern Argentina. This is a special time, not just because we got to go to southern Argentina to talk about stem cells and cancer, but because we got a very large, highly active anti-leukemia stem cell therapy grant, Halt Leukemia, and that was from CIRM. And it was just the first time we had this global collaboration when it was a Canada, California Cancer Stem Cell Initiative. And really that set the stage for everything I'm going to talk about today. In addition to working with somebody when I was doing grad school at the University of British Columbia, who said, you can't just look at the coding sequences when 50% of our DNA is comprised of repetitive elements. These intergenic sequences must make a difference. And in fact, as part of the Halt Leukemia grant, we started to do not just genomics, but really deep transcriptomics with Mark O'Mara, who actually took over for the person who discovered that. So there were a lot of us excited, and this is just to say I had to show the excitement of this team last night. All of you are going to make a difference here, and I think, you know, I just wanted to reflect in the mirror room here on some of the things we've seen. I think that fundamental science matters. With the person I was talking about who talked about the intergenic sequences and ALUs in particular, he lost all his funding. He was actually wrapping up his lab, putting his lab into boxes. Nobody liked this idea. They said it's junk DNA. So sometimes you have to stick with the unpopular and go with the data, and maybe sometimes should be all the time. Anyway, he woke up the next morning to discover that he'd won the Nobel Prize for site-directed mutagenesis, and that was Mike Smith. So he helped us all with site-directed mutagenesis, but what he was really getting at is la condition humaine, there's something unique to humans. Where we respond to stress, we're activating the dark genome, and I'm going to talk about that. Where does this inflammation come from under conditions of stress? And I'm going to suggest it's from our repetitive elements. Now, why does this matter for stem cells and regenerative medicine, which had been aspirational, but you see today there are a lot of things we've done with the Alpha Clinic and scientists in the room, physicians working together to really bring regenerative medicine to the clinic. And you know, with stem cells, as John Dick described, they have self-renewal or regenerative capacity. They can become dormant, and they can give rise to every type of cell in the tumor. So when I was a bone marrow transplanter, I would think you can only replace stem cells. You have to give somebody else's stem cells, when in fact now we can gene correct and use editing technologies, as well as we heard from Mark Walters and others on the Alpha Clinic panel. So regenerative medicine, as Sheldon was alluding to, is a whole spectrum of activities. We can do stem cell replacement, as we do on the Cell and Regenerative Medicine Service, but also enhance stem cell repair, figure out when stem cells have gone awry, like John was alluding to, and see if we can pick out these CD83 positive cells, enhance stem cell regeneration, reduce stem cell degeneration by getting rid of cancer stem cells. So this is the whole crux of what we're doing here at the Sanford Stem Cell Institute. We started September 2nd of 2022. We have six centers and a brain tumor program, each with a director, deputy director, or co-directors. And more recently, we started the brain tumor and neurorestoration program. So we've been able to do a lot. As Sheldon showed, we're doing over 300 clinical trials now, and a lot of them are first in human, first in the world. So we wanted to accelerate this whole process of discovery. And so people may think, why space? Why biomanufacturing or commercial IP? Why work in space at all? And Jennifer Buckley is here from NASA. Rihanna is here as an astronaut at the back who's helped us with some of these experiments. Well, we started to look at what BMS and Merck did together for the protein crystallization of Keytruda, which is a drug that's a game changer for cancer. It actually leads to increased sensitivity to the immune system, and the problem was we had to give it IV. By working together in space to resolve the crystal structure of Keytruda binding to its target PD-1, they were able to make an injectable form, so now anybody can just waltz into the clinic, get an injection, and be gone in a few minutes. So that improved the process for formulation, but we also find that there are drug stability issues that we can't solve on Earth. You can do that in space. That's been proven. Reduce drug transportation and storage costs, potentially with Dream Chaser, and I'll talk about that at the end if anybody asks. But also, we can start to measure stem cell fitness and longevity under conditions of stress. The other thing, when I was talking to Bob Langer, who is the co-founder of Moderna, and it's on our executive council for the Sanford Stem Cell Institute, as is Liz Blackburn and a number of others, he started to say, but what about intellectual property? What if you discover a new molecule or enable the production of that molecule that could constitute new intellectual property, not just for the making of the compound, but actually for novel drug formulations and the diagnostics and therapeutics approach? So there are a lot of opportunities in space, and I would ask everybody to join us there, because in the seven missions that we've done to the ISS, we found that they've all been illuminating. So we started to look at the NASA Twin Study. This was in Stella's journalism, calling it science. And basically what we saw with Scott Kelly is he came back 2 inches taller than his identical twin brother after just about a year in space. And the only issue was he had evidence of immune dysfunction, pre-malignant changes in the blood, including inversions, translocations, which as a leukemia doc, I don't like to see. Increased inflammatory growth factor expression, that kind of stuck with us because we started to look at this and said, wait a minute, those are signs of environmental stress, and they may be part of a fight or flight response, but they also activate these enzymes called base deaminases, both APABEC and ADAR. And the reason those are important is those are the very enzymes that repress the repetitive elements that I talked to you about that Mike Smith was so taken with when I was in grad school. So, getting back to John Dick's point about clonal hematopoiesis, when do our stem cells start to go awry, and how much of this is predestined, or how much of this is an environmental trigger? How much of it is us just anticipating things, and how much is stress? So we started to look at clonal hematopoietic mutations that a number of groups have discovered and started to say a lot of this is not actually in the DNA, it's actually occurring at the RNA level, or is dependent on inflammation and actually the activation of these base deaminases like APABEC and ADAR. So these are the inflammation-dependent enzymes that introduce C to T changes in our DNA and adenosine to inosine changes in our RNA, leading to both genomic and epitranscriptomic instability. So why does this matter? From the Sanger, with Peter Campbell, Mike Stratton, Ludmila Alexandrov, and Mia Petliuk, they showed that these APABEC apoBec enzymes, and we have seven, they're primate specific, can introduce C to T mutations into our DNA and genomic instability under conditions of chronic inflammation. And this happens episodically because they're inflammatory growth factor driven, and we thought, well, that's not very common. They're the number two signature in all cancers, number two. So this C to T mutagenesis pattern, number two signature in all cancers, when does it start? Does it start only when we transform to a full-blown cancer? Does it start at a precancer stage? And what else happens? So we know that apoBec 3, there are seven of them, a couple of the apoBecs can actually induce the production of IL-6, the inflammatory cytokine that David Cherish has studied and showed in epithelial cancers. This is really important because it activates STAT3, and that leads to the activation of cancer stem cell pathways. But also, IL-6 will activate ADAR1, that's the RNA editing enzyme. And the reason that enzyme matters is it leads to cancer's capacity to clone itself or malignant regeneration, but also immune evasion by turning off interferon. So that's an interferon-stimulated gene that then turns off interferon signaling and leads to an immune silencing in the tumor microenvironment. So what we found a few years ago is that ADAR and apoBec work together in these disorders called myeloproliferative neoplasms. They're relatively rare, but they're becoming more prevalent because David and I and others made a drug called a JAK2 inhibitor, fedratinib, to block this, and a number of other people have worked on these. The only thing is, the disease can be progressing in the background if we don't hit the JAK-STAT signaling pathway hard enough, and you get activation of both ADAR and apoBec. So you're creating genomic instability and actually allowing those pre-malignant cells to now clone themselves because of ADAR and apoBec working together as a bad Bonnie and Clyde show. So we looked into mechanisms, and what we found was that ADAR can actually edit the microRNA binding region in the 3' UTR of MDM2. And the reason that matters is then you repress P53. So it's haploinsufficiency of the tumor suppressor, but through editing, not through mutation. And this is all inflammatory cytokine driven. We know we can dial this down a bit with fedratinib, that drug that David Cherish and I and others were involved in making. And we thought we were being very clever to discover this in myeloproliferative neoplasms and leukemia stem cells and AML, but as usual, somebody else was thinking more broadly, and this is Gordon Mills, Han Liang, Jidmili Li. They showed ADAR is activated in 17 different cancers. They looked at 6,500 malignancies that had become therapeutically recalcitrant, and ADAR was massively upregulated in all of those 17 malignancies. So we just discovered ADAR in three blood cancers, but they discovered it in 17 different solid tumors. Now, this is the work done by Teresa Spacito in the lab, who's shown actually ADAR is a metastatic switch. It doesn't just lead to immune silencing and therapeutic resistance. When she implants triple-negative breast cancer in the brain of neonatal mice and they start to develop that malignancy, they turn on this ADAR reporter that is green fluorescent protein positive when they decide to metastasize down the spinal cord. When they do that, they activate another self-renewal gene, beta-catenin, and an immune evasion gene that blocks programmed cell death called CD47. But not just any CD47, it's a very specific isoform of CD47. So there's a splice isoform switch there that really augments immune evasion. So now that we're getting samples from Dr. Kafori Beaumont, Dr. Alex Kalesi, and others, we're starting to look at brain metastatic lesions, and we find in lung cancer that's gone to the brain, breast cancer that's gone to the brain, very high level ADAR P150, so that's the inflammatory cytokine inducible isoform. Metastatic breast cancer, tumor organoid models, very high ADAR expression when we use that reporter. Same with GBM, glioblastoma multiforme. The difference there, it just keeps growing. It grows like a weed. It's kind of scary. This is at 60 days. Again, that's Teresa and our biorepository team with Inga and Emma and others being able to get these samples. So as I mentioned, ADAR can induce this malignant regeneration or cloning capacity of cancer. And then a number of groups actually showed it's an essential driver of immune evasion in cancer because it prevents the activation of interferon. So T cells go, I don't care. I'm not going to do anything. I'm here, but interferon's not telling me to be active. So it's a major pathway for immune silencing in cancer. So we started working on blocking that production of ADRP-150, the isoform. We've made a drug that we're calling Rubexinib after Rebecca Morse, and I co-founded a company called Aspira to really take that small molecule to the clinic. But the point is we can block the production of that ADRP-150, and that works in xenograft models that Wen Ma has created in the lab. These are serial transplantation models. We block leukemia stem cell propagation. And then with Inga van der Werf and others, we've shown that we can really look at ADAR as a driver of leukemia stem cells in pediatric AML as well. So that will be another important target. But how do we do this without following patients prospectively? We decided to make a nanobioreactor that I call a canary in a coal mine. My dad was a coal mining engineer. He would talk about canaries can sense carbon monoxide. And so carbon monoxide is lethal because we can't smell it. We need carbon monoxide sensors in our homes. In the mines, it used to be literally canaries. So we've developed a cancer and aging stem cell nanobioreactor with artificial regenerative intelligence systems, and I'll explain what that means. The AI algorithms that Space Tango has developed to track our stem cells in these nanobioreactors actually tells you where the regenerating stem cells are. So the cell cycle reporter that we use in this little nanobioreactor, which is essentially a pediatric blood bag with surgiform sponge, we put 34 negative stromal cells, thanks to Anna Khachaturian, providing 550 individual age normal bone marrow samples from her patients who have consented for research. And basically, with those samples, we were able to establish these nanobioreactors. We put in the Fuchi system. We made this with Roger Chen, who got the Nobel Prize for GFP. And basically, if our stem cells are asleep, they're usually happy. Our blood stem cells want to be asleep in red 80% of the time. If they're green, they're in cycle, G2M. If they're yellow, they're dividing. We can detect in the same nanobioreactor whether stem cells are adhering to cancer cells and actually contributing to the niche, or we can look at other tissue types like liver, and as I showed you, brain organoids. So this is a longevity device that detects stem cell aging, precancer, and cancer stem cells under conditions of stress that are episodic. So we did this experiment in space with Space Tango. Jessica Pham has done all of these experiments. We did 4 missions to the ISS, and what we found in our ground controls is that we maintain this healthy red population of stem cells. But in space, what we have is this proliferative burst. It's kind of partying like our son, who's in his second year of undergrad. But after a little while, those stem cells get exhausted, and there are actually very few red dormant stem cells left. So this is after 30 days in space. So then we started to think, how exhausted are these cells? Is this going to affect their longevity? Is it going to affect their telomere state and regenerative potential? So we started to look at telomere length, but also C-strand synthesis, so the replication of telomeres, as our 2 Nobel laureates have described over the last couple of days, Elizabeth Blackburn and Tom Cech. And so we started to look at this with whole genome sequencing. This was telomere cat. My name's Cat, so I like the name. But anyway, we look at repetitive or telomeric repeats by whole genome sequencing, 90x coverage. And what we saw in these experiments was a trend toward a reduction in telomere length. That was a trend, but what was significant was the reduction in the genes involved in telomere maintenance and replication, and that's the CST poly-1 complex, and that was the biggest hit that we saw, as you see here. So that was a bit of a surprise. The other thing is, back to John's talk about clonal hematopoiesis, what we started to see was acquisition of clonal hematopoietic mutations in space, or at least just more mutations in general, but they were single base substitution mutations, and they tended to be C to T mutations that correspond with APABEC activation. And so what we saw was that those changes we saw in space weren't just because of radiation, because Jessica did the radiation experiments on the ground. They seem to be associated with microgravity and loss of adhesion to the niche, and then the cells are no longer regulated properly. They activate APABEC, introducing that C to T mutagenesis, and 5-fold more mutations in space than on the ground, with only about 1/5 of those related to radiation. So this is where I'm going with the dark genome. So this goes back to Mike Smith. My mom calls it the Darth Vader of the genome because our repetitive elements are inherited. And Luke, I am your father, is what I was thinking when I was looking at these data. And basically what we saw in our flights in all four missions to the ISS and the nanobioreactor is activation of repetitive elements, complete deregulation of repetitive elements, human endogenous retroviral sequences, as well as line elements. And we think this is what's activating APRBEC. Now, when you have an inflammatory initiation because of repetitive element activation, initially you activate APRBEC and ADAR, but then ADAR is repressed because interferons activate and tell us ADAR to go down. So essentially what happens is you lose the regenerative capacity of those cells, they no longer self-renew. So then we started to say, is the same thing happening in astronauts? Is this an artifact of our nanobioreactor? So we started to look at space-associated stem cell hallmarks of aging in the Axiom 2 and 3 crew. Thank you, Pinar. Thank you, Jana, for helping to coordinate all these experiments. Jessica, our biorepository team, Inga, Emma, everyone, but really the most to Rihanna, who is one of these intrepid astronauts. I don't know who's who in this because I'm not allowed to know. It's a HIPAA-protected data set. But I'll tell you, we looked at 10 mils of blood, 34 positive stem cell-enriched populations versus 34 negative cells by whole genome sequencing, whole transcriptome, single cell sequencing. And then Larissa Blaine in the lab did the functional analysis with clonogenic assays and replating. And so this has been quite an endeavor. We looked at AX2, that was 10 days, AX3, 21 days. And basically, this just shows you the setup. The same person we heard about earlier, Patrick Chang, did the single cell sequencing analysis. And what we found in AX2 and AX3 is that in flight, we get a slight shift in populations, and it's more prominent in AX3. So maybe this is your HSCIM, inflammatory memory population. We'll have to compare notes, John. But what we saw was an initial proliferative burst, and then the cells become exhausted. And this is something that Larissa showed is temporally important. It's basically more profound when it comes to self-renewal loss, when you've been in space for 21 days instead of 10 days. So the amount of time you're exposed to stress in space matters. The other thing I wanted to mention, though, is we saw a trend towards CD34 positive stem cell mobilization 2 days before launch. So it looks like we have a fight or flight response and anticipate these changes. But the good news is most astronauts recover their stem cell function. What we see, and that goes all the way out to a year, so for the AX2 crew, we're seeing that they recover their telomere length after a year. And we don't have a year yet for AX3 crew, but what we are seeing are changes still in that Poly1 CST primase complex. So that didn't quite go back to normal. And then the other thing is we saw signs of mitochondrial stress gene activation. Now the mitochondrial stress gene activation depends on whether you've been in space for 10 days or 21 days. So if you've been in space for 21 days, it's night and day. They absolutely deregulate mitochondrial genes. So the time and space matters. The other thing we see is, again, the dark genome being activated. So if you look at when people are in flight, they look quite different from a repetitive element standpoint. And what Claire has been doing in the lab now has been looking at repetitive element expression in relation to ADAR and APRBEC activation, again in that stem cell-enriched population at the different time points. So we did all the sequencing at day minus 30, day minus 2 before launch, in flight, day plus 1 after return, day plus 30, and in the case of AX2 a year later. So now we're able to do repetitive element analysis at the single cell level. And I guess the most important hallmark of aging is of aging in space, space-associated clonal hematopoiesis. What we see is that after 10 days in space, not too bad, not too many mutations. These are all the individuals. But after 3 weeks, there's a massive level of clonal hematopoiesis. And what we don't know is, are these clones going to be retained, or are they going to be competitively unfit? Well, what we're concerned about is after 3 weeks in space, we're seeing APRBEC 3C go up. And then basically we're concerned that there will be a level of genomic instability for people that have spent over 3 weeks in space. The other thing we're seeing, and that has to do with Artem Patipudian's talk, is piezo-1 activation. And that piezo-1 activation, we think, is a good thing. We think it allows regenerative potential of stem cells. If you think about how stem cells are born out of the aorta, they're born into a high shear stress state. They activate RUNX1 and RUNX2. That's a regenerating cell, and that eventually goes down. And if you spend too long in space, you lose that population. So what about, I've talked about pre-cancer in the last couple of minutes. I'm just going to show you a couple of slides. What happens if you send full-blown cancer into space? So we send leukemia into space. These are Axiom missions 1, 2, and 3. We put in the ADAR reporter in leukemia, or the Fuchi system in solid tumor organoids. And what we found is cancers triple in size in space in just 10 days. And the scary part with the Fuchi system is they become quiescent in space compared to ground controls where they're still dividing. In other words, they're going to be impervious to therapies that target dividing cells. They activate ADAR. We can see that by whole transcriptome sequencing. They edit more in specific regions. So what we thought is we need some help. And so the Axiom 1, 2, and 3 crew astronauts helped us with our tumor organoid experiments. Here is Walter Villaday making sure the breast cancer organoid experiment is in the right orientation. Again, this is an Axiom crew member. He's a European Space Agency astronaut. And what we found in AX2 and AX3 was we could dial down ADAR activity based on GFP expression here. But really, it was the Axiom 3 mission that you just saw Walter Villaday doing that showed us that rubexinib is an ADAR inhibitor, is much more potent than fedratinib. And that got published, the raw data got published in Fortune magazine, which is the first time we've ever published raw data in a magazine. But anyway, that kind of set the stage for the Cancer Moonshot funding. Thank you, Jennifer, and NASA members for the Igniting Innovation grant, because this ignites a lot more in terms of understanding model systems and how we can model human hematopoietic stem cell aging, pre-malignancy and malignancy at the stem cell level. So we've got a couple of drugs we think we can turn back the clock and get back to pre-cancer or normal aged stem cells. And really, this has all taken a very large group of people all working together, undaunted by lack of sleep. And, you know, I'd really like to thank everybody who's helped with this work, Sierra Space, Space Tango, Axiom. We're going to be working with Sierra soon, NASA, T. Denny Sanford. And I'd just like to show you the first launch, and this will take...
3, 2, 1...
So that was Axiom 1. That was the first launch of tumor organoids into space. And we were able to accelerate the development of a drug because of space. So we're pretty excited about the future. We think the future is predicated on industry, academia, and philanthropy all working together, and of course, together with our colleagues. And this is why it matters. This is one of my patients, Sandra. She was at our Medicine Informing Novel Discoveries event. She's sitting next to Peggy Whitson, who discovered rubexinib as the cancer kill switch. And we were talking about the NASA Decadal Survey, the next 10 years, 10 years of results. Her response to that is, I plan to be here to see it. And that's what we need to do together. We need to give people a longer horizon, a longer runway, and that we can do together. So thank you, everybody, for being at the meeting. I really appreciate everything that people have contributed to the meeting.